hi, folks. Fred Reno here, and welcome to episode number 12 of the Fine Wine Confidential podcast. And thank you for continuing with me on my journey to chronicle the fantastic wine quality revolution happening here in Virginia's wine growing. In this episode, I introduce you to Dukart Vineyards and Scott Aleph, the owner and founder. I had the pleasure to sit down with him at his winery just before Christmas of 2020. His winery is nestled into the foothills of the Shenandoah National Park on an eastern-facing slope at an elevation of 1,000 feet. Dukart is committed to sustainable practices in all they do and earned the distinction as Virginia's greenest winery several years ago. Take a listen. Scott, welcome to my podcast, and thank you for giving me this time this afternoon.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So let's start, as always, at the beginning. What's your story? How'd you get into this?
Repeat onset temporary insanity, I think, is what it really comes down to. There's really no plan, actually. We bought a country place out here. You could see it out the back of the tasting room here. And it was just a getaway from D.C. It was an old dead apple orchard. It hadn't been farmed in probably 50 years. Hmm. And I was type A enough even then that I wasn't going to leave that alone. And so I got the experts out to help me think about what to do with it. And I thought I'd be replanting the apples. And the local guys said, no, I wouldn't do the apple business, but this would actually be a good site for a vineyard.
Did you have a... notable viticulturists who then came in here, or was this just local people giving you this advice?
Well, I'm a suburban kid from Chicago, and these guys were from the Extension Service, Virginia Tech Extension Service, and I didn't know what that was. Mm-hmm. I didn't know why we had tech schools, any of that kind of stuff, but these guys are in every county of the country to help people with agriculture, and that was my first introduction to it. I asked him why this would be a good site for a vineyard. And he said, well, first of all, it was a very successful apple orchard back in the day, and the old-timers kind of knew for location and angle of the sun and frost and so forth. And also that it had really crummy, really rocky soil. And I thought, wait a minute, this is not growing corn in Iowa or something. It was the beginning of my kind of re-education that we wanted really crummy soil and that kind of stressed the vines and everything. And so... I looked into it, and then I got various experts involved. We have a handful of people in Virginia who have been just terrific in helping people get started. This right. was 20 years ago, and most of them are still around. And
who was your lead person?
I talked to Luca at Barbersville, Dennis Horton, who's since passed away. Mm-hmm. Gabrielle Rouse, of course.
So, yeah.
People came out here and visited and said, they thought it would be a good site, and welcome to the party. And so,
what year was it? That you planted 2001?
That was 2001, I think. Yeah. And we cleared the site and prepped it. And of course, the first decision you have to make is what varieties you're going to choose.
I was going to say, what led you to the varieties you planted?
The scary thing, I mean, even after being re-educated that a crummy soil would be a good site, was, okay, I'm going to put these vines in the ground. And by the way, they're going to be in the ground probably, we don't know, but maybe 50 years. And you better get it right because there are a lot of varieties that won't grow well here. So I spent a lot of time researching it and reading about it and basically knocking on the door of just about everybody I could find to see, pick their brain on their experience and so forth. But ultimately, you got to make a call and put vines in the ground. And so we put in a Viognier, which you're drinking right now,
which
actually.
Which is very good.
Yeah, and a Cabernet Franc and Petit Verdot and Virginia native Norton. So we have 7 acres on site here, and they said, well, maybe you should start slow and just plant 20 vines, you know, and see how it goes and so forth. So how long will that take? Well, until you get the vines in production and get the wine out and so forth, you know, 5 or 7 or 10 years or something. I said, I'm not going to wait that long to make a decision. I'll do it now and learn as we go. We made every mistake in the book, no doubt. The important thing is you don't make it twice.
How many acres are now planted under vine here?
Yeah, so we planted all 7 acres with those 4 varietals. Now we have 2 other vineyards that we operate around the county.
Oh, you do?
So
okay.
We have 17. Everybody's drinking. They like our wine, so we got to keep on expanding. And, of course, it takes a long time. It's not easy to do that. So we planted them, and learned from experience what worked, what didn't, what kind of techniques, and so forth.
Where are the other sites in relationship to this location?
One's over on the side of the mountain to the west a couple of miles, and the other's a little bit further south in the county. But they all share the same characteristic of beautiful mountain views and a little bit of rolling terrain. The mountain that you see out the back here is Old Rag, which is kind of the biggest, most famous mountain in this part of the Shenandoah. It used to be 10,000 feet tall, and now it's 4,000. Well, 6,000 feet of rock basically slid off of the side over the eons and is 1 foot under the surface of the vineyard here. So it's a crazy interesting place to be growing grapes, actually.
Are the three different sites, do they have equal amounts of varietals, or are there certain varietals that do better in certain sites?
Yeah, we're still learning, you know. I mean, the whole industry is learning on that. We planted the Chardonnay over on the second site and some Merlot because we knew those were good varietals we wanted, and planted some more Viognier over there as well. All of them have taken. All of them have been fine, but that site is particularly good for the Chardonnay and for the Merlot. And our site is particularly good for the Petit Verdot, as it turns out. So
I think you've answered my question, which was very simply, what was the wine in your mind that you modeled? In other words, did you grow up and then get into wine drinking, or did this all just was a confluence when you came here?
Yeah, well, you're going to shake your head, but there were, like I said, there was no plan at all. I mean, I was kind of a beer-drinking frat boy college guy, you know, refined my taste since then, but I don't come from any particular wine background and so forth. I remember I thought I was going to be planting apples and grapes. And so we learned as we went along. My probably seminal experience was when we went to France in my 30s or so, and we were buying wine and just, you know, sitting on the steps of the Seine having lunch from the little shops and everything. And my wife and I would look at ourselves and say, man, this wine is just really, really good. And it always stuck with us since then. And then that concept that we could plant a vineyard here and aspire to grow really good wines here was always very alluring, as it is for many people.
So when you start to produce wine, you start to get going, you're a former management consultant of some note. You're branding. So you got to sit around, you got to figure out, okay, what's my package look like? What's my brand name going to be? It's not going to be Elif. So tell me that story that we had discussed before, how Ducard came to be.
Yeah. I didn't want it to be Elif. Nobody even pronounces it right anyway, but I wanted it to be something that had some sort of fun significance. And there's a single malt scotch that goes way back in my family. My great, I don't know how many great grandmothers founded and ran the Cardhu Distillery, C-A-R-D-H-U, Cardhu Distillery in Scotland. And so I thought it would be fun to use that name in some way or another. But Cardhu is still in existence, and it's owned by a big conglomerate now. So I can't use that name because they own the name. But I took it and just sort of flipped it around and called it Ducard instead.
That's just brilliant. I think that's brilliant.
And so it doesn't mean anything in French. It doesn't mean anything dirty. It's just it's a term and fun. Sounds kind of French. So we ran with it. And as you saw when you came in, there's a picture of Elizabeth Cumming, the great-great-great-grandmother founder, and a picture of a bottle of Cardhu behind our bar, together with our bottles, of course. And
right.
So we named it that, and off we went.
So of the 17, 18 acres of vineyard you farm, that is the sole source of your grapes for your production?
Yeah, that's right. That's another sort of, I guess, a thing I learned along the way is, you know, when I started, pretty much it was all guys who just had a small operation, planted their own, tended their own vines, made their own wine, sold them on site. Very kind of old world, little Burgundy winemaker kind of thing, or a Bordeaux winemaker or whatever. And I really like that idea because it certainly had such an authenticity to it. And since then, I've learned that it's so important that you control your own production anyway and the quality of your grapes. So our model, business model, if you will, is that we grow all our own grapes, or 90-something percent, basically, ourselves.
So you can call up your wine estate bottle.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you were in the right AVA locations and all that stuff, but grown and operated by us. And then we make the wine in the building back behind here and sell 99% of it at our tasting room, with people on the patio looking out at the mountains and after a hike or having a nice getaway or coming out for a bed and breakfast or something like that.
Well, how did you build an audience then to be able to get a clientele coming here and be able to be so direct to the consumer on site? How did that?
Yeah.
How were you able to build this audience?
It's a constant struggle because, as you know, we're not in the middle of nowhere out here. We're at the end of nowhere. Internet's a powerful thing. People are looking for something fun to do. It's a gorgeous area. Lots of historical significance out here. People come out here to hike in Shenandoah National Park and to stay at local bed and breakfast. The country inns has a certain getaway feel compared to D.C. or Richmond or other places. And people trickle down out of the national park, too, to come for extra enjoyment and entertainment and so forth.
Is there a close access to the national park?
Yeah, there's one to the north and one to the south, so people kind of put it into a, you know, a traveling loop for themselves when they're spending some time in the park. And so we just built it kind of one step at a time here, and we advertise and we get some recognition for awards and that type of thing, and notoriety maybe for being a green winery, which you mentioned we'll talk about later. But largely you build it through word of mouth and satisfied customers, and that's something I guess I learned from my management consulting is, you know, you want to provide a superior experience to people, and the experience is the quality of the wine, the quality of the view, the quality of the staff, the quality of, you know, every individual step in the operation. And we've been able to do that. It worked to our favor, and we're delighted to have a nice customer base and love having people come out to visit.
So you've been growing grapes pretty close to 20 years now. Have you seen in that period of time any relevant significance, or have you seen climate change in some level and you've seen an effect on your farming?
Yeah, it's a little, yes and yes, I think is the answer, but it's a little hard to tease it out exactly because the weather from year to year can be so different. We don't have wildfires like and mudslides like Napa does, but we have just about everything else. We have hurricanes that they don't have in there. We have a lot of spring frost issues, a lot of heat and humidity. I mean, it's kind of an unnatural act to be growing grapes in Virginia here, and you've got to fine-tune your practices and everything and limit your yield and put a lot of labor into the vineyards to make sure that the grapes stay disease-free and ripen appropriately and everything to the standard that we want for our top-end wines.
Your elevation here is about 1,000 feet?
About 1,000 feet,
so
yeah.
It helps mitigate a little bit of the frost.
Yeah, right. But this year we had, I think there were 7 different frost events in Virginia. This vineyard was not affected at all. Thank goodness it was an old apple orchard, right? I guess the old-timers knew. Our second vineyard was not affected at all, but our third vineyard was hit by one of the events right at the primary bud coming out, so we lost all the primaries. And then it got hit a second time when the secondary buds came out, so we got 0 crop on that. So we lost about a third of our production overall this year, and that's the first time that that's happened to us, but it's, you know, certainly a wake-up call. So if there's climate change and global warming, then you get a little bit less, you know, frost likelihood, of course, but you got more heat and more humidity in the summertime. So, and more intense weather and more hurricanes that naturally come right at harvest and screw you up. There's a little bit of everything out to get us all the time here in the viticulture business.
Well, exactly. In fact, over the years when I would talk to businessmen and people who were not in the wine business, and they'd always be this allure. They'd always say, well, God, it looks so great. It's romantic, right? And all this sort of stuff. And I'd look at them and go, it's farming.
Yeah, it is farming. That's
it's
right.
It's just farming. That's really what it is at its base.
Yeah. But I think the difference is, and I mentioned the sort of authenticity aspect to it and the importance of the quality of the grapes, is that our business model is growing our own grapes so we control our supply. Increasingly now, as the industry has grown, there are a number of wineries that pretty much focus their capital and their attention on building a nice tasting room. And they buy the grapes from other people, in some cases California, and sometimes they have other people make the wine for them. And it's just it's a different model. Maybe they're smarter than me, but I feel that, like, if we grow all our own grapes and make all our own wine, the people who are coming are seeing the real deal. They're seeing the terroir. They're seeing what we do on our site with our hands and everything.
Well, and I will agree with you on this regard, because what you do here is what I say, you're in the wine business. You're in the wine growing business.
We're all in this thing. Yeah, no question about it.
And that was the one thing I saw when I moved to Virginia, how many wineries I would say were in the hospitality business,
yeah, right,
as opposed to the
right.
wine business.
Right. Now, not that there aren't great, you know, contract growers, and we have some excellent contract winemakers, but it's just it's a different model. I think the people that we want to come out here, and the reason that they bond to the place is they know that we got the dirty fingernails in doing the whole thing start to finish, and they're looking out at our grapes, and they're walking through our winery and seeing what we're doing, and hear the stories and so forth, the travails and the satisfactions and so forth, and they kind of. Relate to that in a way that you don't if you just go into a hospitality business and people are pouring wine from who knows where.
Well, how does one become noted as the greenest, most sustainable, if you will, winery in Virginia? That's pretty serious accolade.
Yeah,
many wineries here?
Yeah, we built the winery 10 years ago, and I don't think the green thing had caught on quite as much as it is now. There are people who probably surpassed us in terms of the extent of the practices and so forth, but this was my baby, and so I said, like, just like the wines, we're going to do it right with the facilities. And so we're solar powered for the most part here. You see the panels, which is a delicious irony because you use the sun to ripen your grapes, and so using the same sun to power your building is pretty cool thing to be able to do. I don't think you drove a Tesla in here today, but we got a Tesla power station for people.
Awesome.
Too. So that's nice. But also, it's reclaimed lumber that we hand-harvested from the back 40. A lot of things in the tasting room we've been able to do, like eliminate plastics for the most part. We use cornstarch and potato starch for cutlery and for cups and that type of thing. We even use lightweight bottles to bottle, so we have a smaller carbon footprint in what we do and so forth. So there are a million different practices that you can do, and all decisions that you make that can be more or less sustainable and better for the environment. And a lot of them cost more than just go in the traditional way, but I guess I felt like I wanted to make a statement, make an investment, and most importantly, feel comfortable that what I was doing was the best I could possibly do and be a good steward of nature around here.
So of the wines you produce, and I want to get into that in a second with you, who your winemaker is and how you came to that decision, of the wines you produce, if there is such a thing, what is your favorite?
I'm sure everybody tells you this. It's all my children, right?
Right.
We're especially proud, I think, of the Viognier that we have here that you're drinking, and also the Petit Verdot has worked out very well for us. And we only have 1 acre of it here. We're rapidly planting or replanting on one of our sites to get more. But as you know, that means we have a whole whopping worldwide production of 100 cases a year. And our wine club gets about half of that right off the bat. So the Petit Verdot, when it's released, it's available for maybe 2 or 3 months, and that's it.
Right.
And, unfortunately, you have people coming in and say, what do you mean it's sold out? How come you don't just order more? You know, it just shows you kind of disconnect. Some people are disconnected from the source supply. I point out in the vineyard and say, that's the warehouse. It's just not, that's the factory, just not ready to spit anything out yet. So,
Your winemaker is from Bordeaux?
He is, yeah. He came before we even opened the winery.
And, oh, really?
Yeah, he grew up with a vineyard in his family, so knee-high to a grasshopper. He was out there working in the vines and everything. Young guys in the French industry are encouraged to come to the U.S. because the U.S. is the biggest global market, maybe until China takes over or something. So the French, to their credit, said, you all go over there for an internship or something and, you know, learn what makes Americans tick, because the French guys need to be able to sell their wines to, you know, to America. So he came over here for a 3-month internship 14 years ago and has been here ever since.
And never left.
He's a big fish in a small pond, and my management style is for him to run with it, and we're always after continuous improvement, and what can we take from what he knew growing up and how they do things in France, and same sort of, you know, boutique, small winery operation kind of way and vineyard way. That's what we've been doing year after year.
Well, that gives you, obviously, a really good continuity of wine quality and style, and where you're headed with what you're trying to do.
Right. And we're totally on the same page that way. And he's both the head guy in the vineyard and the head guy in the winery. So there's no pointing fingers about, you know, the grapes weren't good enough for me as a winemaker. Well, you're the one that grew them. So we keep it tight that way.
Do you have any children that are in the business?
My adult daughter is working in the tasting room some, which is delightful for me. She's not so excited about bugs, so I don't think I'll ever get her out in the vineyard.
Okay.
She, I think, is one of these super tasters that has a really great palate, but as a 20-something, she's really not into wine particularly. So she knows all about it. She's watched it all from day one, and she's excellent in the tasting room and works in the back office some in terms of reservations and merchandising and, you know, that type of thing. So that's fun for me, for sure.
I see you're connected, and I'd love to understand this a little bit more deeply. You're connected to Piedmont Community College, and you have some exchange and things going on. What's your work with them entail? What's that like?
Right. Well, when I started out, remembering again, I didn't know anything. I looked around for courses to take, and there weren't any. But as we got started, PVCC began a workforce development program to teach people about viticulture and winemaking, recognizing that that was a good alternative for people compared to, you know, going to college and being an English major or something. You know, they actually work a real workforce skill. And so they developed courses, and most of them were kind of slideshows that happened to be held in wineries. And so I took all those, even though we were already in the business. And I said to them, well, you need a hands-on kind of course, that the way that you learn is to actually by doing. It's a little bit like in school, if you had some lab courses versus lecture courses, you know, lecture courses were fine. You'd write down the notes and spit them back and so forth. But you learn more about 3 days in the lab, actually, than you do in the whole lecture course. So we set up a course where you basically adopt a row of our vines, and you come out all summer long from pruning in February in the wintertime all the way through to harvest in October. And under our guidance, you basically do each step in the vineyard and winery cycle.
Oh, they must love that. That's fantastic.
And so that adds to the other kind of coursework. And a lot of people who are looking to get into the business, then they really have a qualification that say, I actually worked in a vineyard all summer long. It's been useful for people who are thinking about getting into the business, people who moved to the Charlottesville area, buy a nice estate. What am I going to do with this land? Maybe I should plant some grapes, like you said. It's so alluring. We tell them to take this class first, and what always happens at the end is they go, it's way too much work.
It's a lot of work.
Stay a consumer. And from my standpoint, that's a victory, too. We've helped them avoid something that would have been out of control for them or not the right match or whatever, but they have better appreciation for it. And so it's a win regardless of how it works out.
So with 20 years' worth of hindsight, if there was one thing you could do differently, what would that have been?
Oh, my goodness. There are a lot of things I would have done differently, but the philosophy and approach that I chose and that we've executed is exactly what I think is the right thing to do and what fulfills it for me. It's, you know, it's small and it's subscale and it's high cost, and it's, we're very small in a big world of wine. Even Virginia is a dot on the landscape. It's uphill in all respects, and weather like we talked about and everything. When you get a glass of your own wine in hand and you're looking out over your estate, you're pretty proud of it, and people are enjoying it, it's about as good a fulfillment as you'll get.
I've just had a sip of your Viognier. What vintage is this?
This is 2017.
17. Folks, if you can buy a bottle of Ducard Viognier, you should. This is really the real deal. Tremendous focus. Mm. Really precise.
Nice. Thank you.
No, really, really nice wine. So I see you're big on philanthropic endeavors, and you support a tremendous, I mean, almost too many to mention right here, local groups and charities. And talk about that side of your business and what drives you here.
Well, this is, as you can tell, it's a second or third career for me, so it's not really about making the maximum amount of money, if there is any money to be made in any of this.
Not the wine business.
But it's a lot more about fulfillment and doing something that's enjoyable and long-lasting and you feel proud about. One of the things that I think of the wine as kind of our currency. I mean, God knows you don't have any hard currency when you're in this business, but you've got wine. So I try to use it to support various local endeavors and everything. Even this summer with COVID, I watched CNN and saw all the heartbreaking stories of these frontline workers, you know, you feel so inferior and helpless compared to all the great things that, they're doing. You know, what are we doing? We're just tending some grapevines, staying out of the way. So what we did is we took a batch of our rosé and made it a Thank You Heroes label rosé, where people could buy it and they could write the name of their hero, like a doctor or a nurse or something, or a frontline worker of some kind or another, on it, and we would deliver it to them. As just a little special thing.
And that's terrific.
The proceeds were donated to the local nonprofit foundation that distributed them for people in need, and even for psychological programs to help the doctors who were getting, you know, overwhelmed by the caseload and everything. So does it make a, you know, is it a big difference? No, but it's the kind of thing that, I feel like is useful to do, and that we can do it at our scale, and it's a gesture that I think is the right thing to do.
I saw you at one point did some label, some package for Madison Foundation. Is that right?
Well, Madison Heritage. We're actually helping one of the big hospitality, the old lodges here is Graves Mountain Lodge, and they've been here for third, fourth generation, 100 and some years or so. They wanted to partner with us because we represent what they, you know, want to be in a new era of you know, high quality and high customer service and everything. And so we said we would do a wine designated for them called Madison Heritage that recognizes their heritage and the history of the county and everything. So it's a Ducard wine, but it's exclusively for sale over at the lodge.
I see.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting indeed. So you're pretty much 90%+ of your wine comes right directly from here to the consumer. Have you been involved at all in restaurant, when there was a restaurant business?
Well, I got a few friends that have restaurants and they're customers, and so they'd like to have maybe one of our labels in there. We do that on a very limited basis, one or two bed and breakfasts, country inns that have it as well. That's just sort of a sidelight for us, I guess. If their guests or their customers will then have a better recognition of Ducard and come over to hang out at the tasting room, then that's great. But our business is not to ton it out and make a lot of wine and sell it off through distribution to wine shops or something like that. It's a beautiful label, but nobody knows enough about it, and it's no substitute for being out here on our patio and enjoying the experience.
No, it's very, I mean, even this dreary, rainy Monday day, it's beautiful here.
Yeah, we think so.
I mean, I agree. You can just see how nice it is. So you're about 10,000 cases, give or take?
Oh, not even. We're 2,000 or 3,000 cases.
Oh, really. Why did I have that in my mind?
Probably because you need to be 10,000 cases to be survivable in this. But
going back to this idea about it being farming and everything, one of the things I always tell people, the only time the winery really makes any money is when they sell the farm.
Yeah.
That's like every farmer, right?
Yeah, I think I've come into that realization, too.
Up to that point, though, it's about your life and what you want to do.
Right. You're exactly right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I'm envious on one level. One thing I've never done, make wine myself, because it looks really hard.
A lot of things can go wrong. It's a simple process that is fraught with complexities.
I've been an investor in vineyards before, so I understand conceptually all that.
Yeah.
But the winemaking itself, they're like children, right? You got to tend them every day.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So if you had one wine that you would say that you want to make a statement, impress a major press guy, impress some master sommelier or some trade, what would that wine be that you would pull out of your portfolio and say?
Yeah, there is one. It's called Triskel, T-R-I-S-K-E-L-E, Triskelli. And it's a kind of a triangle symbol. That's the tri. It's like, it's a religious symbol in Europe. You see it in churches like Holy Trinity, Father, Son, Holy Ghost, or Earth, Wind, and Fire, or Earth, Wind, and Fire, the band, I suppose, would count, or Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Don't get me going. But, and in our case, it's a blend of three Bordeaux grapes, Cabernet Franc, Merlot, and Petit Verdot. And what we decided to do a few years ago is to release that as a label only in the best years. So if we have a harvest and a growing season that we think is really good and have good product, then we'll devote some of our Cab Franc, Merlot, and Petit Verdot, depending on the season, in that and create that three-part blend. And it's a very limited release. kind of thing that, we try to use it to impress people with. It's beautifully drinking, very deep color, very aromatic, and nice soft tannins. But like all our wines, it's limited to about 100 cases a year usually, so it doesn't go along very well. And in 10 years of having the operation, I think we've done it three times.
Okay.
And we got another one coming out. So, and that probably is an example of what seasons are like out here. There's only three or four out of a decade that you feel are, you know, reasonably above average and that you can make actually your best product.
Well, one comment I will make along the lines of the wine. When I bought some wine here about a month ago when I came through, I bought a bottle of your Chardonnay. And then you and I spoke on the phone a few weeks back before I'd had it. And you had made a comment that you do it in such a style that's more like a good Mécon from France. And when I opened it and poured it in the first glass and smelled it and tasted it, I said, he nailed it. It tastes like, I mean, you absolutely nailed it. It tastes like a really good Mécon.
Yeah.
Congratulations. I mean, it was right there.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, yeah. Mécon being a small town in France, known
exactly.
for the particular style, which is a little bit of oak subtlety, but not buttery. Not the traditional California oaky, buttery, super buttery Chardonnay. And so we do some things in the winery to not allow that development.
What and clone Chardonnay do you have in your vineyard?
We have two or three all Dijon clones.
One of the things I see about vineyard would be really fascinating to hear your thoughts. You've been growing grapes for about 20 years. At some point, the grape varietal itself tends to, what I say, mutate or take on the character of the vineyard in which it's being grown. Have you seen, obviously vine age makes a big difference, but have you seen a gradual character development where you have a signature, you say, okay, out of our vineyard, that's the character we get from
yes.
Cabernet Franc
yes.
or Chardonnay.
Yes, yes. I think that's true for Chardonnay, Cab Franc, and Viognier as well. Maybe Petit Verdot as well. A lot of people in Virginia will talk about Virginia Cabernet Franc as a very distinctive taste in Virginia. Sometimes maybe a little too herbaceous or green from my standpoint, but people drink Cab Francs and they'll say, that's a Virginia Cab Franc. And I think we have a very Virginia Cab Franc, you know, as well. And the Viognier characteristic comes through very strongly. And the Chardonnay, because of the winemaking style, I think, but also the clones and the raw material and everything is part of it, too. So,
well, Chardonnay is the most, in my experience, the most neutral grape.
Yeah.
It's like a blank canvas. And so the vineyard, if you maximize vineyard potential, don't manipulate it, you're going to get a true terroir expressed
yeah.
wine.
Yeah. Well, Julian is speaking French to the vines all the time, so you know you'd think after 15 years maybe they'd be catching on to his instructions.
No, I've been impressed with the limited amount of wine that I've been able to taste. I'm still perplexed because how do you get this audience to continue? I mean, to build and build. When I talk to a couple retailers, of course, which you don't sell wine to, and I ask about Ducard, they either give me a blank stare or like,
yeah.
well, I don't know much about it.
Yeah.
So you got to constantly be working hard to keep the word out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we had an event yesterday for our wine club. Just give you this as an example. I know pretty much all of our wine club members, but sometimes they join and sometimes when I'm not here or whatever. So I was talking with one of them and asked them what their journey was that got them here to our event. And they said they were taking a trip from D.C. and coming down to enjoy the countryside. And they researched TripAdvisor. And we're number one on TripAdvisor, actually, for the area. She said, I saw all these great reviews, and that's a good indicator. And then one of her neighbors, when they were talking, said, oh, you're going down, you should go to Ducard. So their neighbor apparently knew about it. She put those two things together and came out here and had a great time from the get-go and immediately joined the wine club. And it's been, you know, up and at them ever since. A little kind of random various methods get people here, I think. It's not TV advertising, can't do that. It's not wine shops, but it's a lot of word of mouth and reputation and people that want to gravitate toward this sort of style of small, personable, high quality, beautiful location. And they aspire to that just as in these times as a safe place to come and get out of the house, really.
In some ways, that mirrors how I discovered you. My wife was at a farmer's market here in the Charlottesville
right,
area.
Yes.
She bought a bottle of your Norton, brought it home. I'd heard about the car, but I never had one. She brought it home. I said, oh, that's fantastic. I'm really interested. So we had it. It's the best Norton I've ever had. I mean, hands down, is the best Norton I'd ever had from Virginia at that point.
Yeah.
And that's what got my intellectual curiosity going.
Yeah.
I got to stop by. I got to figure out what's going on there. They need to be part of the Fine Wine Confidential podcast. I know there's a story there. But it was that experience that she had that she just randomly bought a bottle from somebody that was working for you or was at this farmer's market.
Right.
So it does work that way.
I admit it's not an overnight success. It's probably not a very efficient way to market, but I think it's very effective because if people find out about things through trusted methods and neighbors and reviews, tastings that they've been to or whatever, and then they kind of zero in and come out here, and hopefully that gets reinforced in what they were looking for, and then they become fans.
As a former management consultant, how did that help you in your decision-making process here as you started the winery?
I think I probably had to blot a lot of that out of my head because the business characteristics of this are long lead time, very weather risky, high capital cost, high labor cost, unbranded, not well recognized even as a whole region of the world for wine and so forth. So it's got, and highly regulated as well, legally and highly taxed. So it has a lot of things going against it. To be successful in it, I think you have to apply all the best disciplines and experience that you can to kind of overcome those sort of things, to be creative and to be focused in one or two or three very specific areas, like what we've been doing with the on-site focus and the green element, the high personability at the tasting room and that type of thing. So you create a niche. I think the world is basically a collection of millions of niches, and you look for a niche that you like, try to really be strong in it. And the people that like that niche or are looking for it, they'll find you. And it's not for everybody. You know, lots of other niches or hobbies or whatever, you know, none of us have any interest in, but they have their own followings, you know, and same thing for that, for here. People like the particular vibe of the place and the following we get is because of that.
What's the one bottle of wine that you've had that you went, wow? I mean, what's the one that sticks in your mind, putting your own wine aside for a second?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, what's that bottle of wine that went, bingo, that's really unbelievable?
Chateau Montelena. That's in your old neck of the woods.
Oh, at one point, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we had a trip to Napa in probably about the 80s or 90s or so. It's a gorgeous facility, as you know. And I didn't know at the time how storied it was and the role that it played in the judgment of Paris and everything. A Cabernet Sauvignon and a Chardonnay from there were two unbelievably memorable wines when we were on our trip. And it's not like we were scouting it thinking that we were going to do this. It was just a vacation. That and probably the wines that we just randomly bought out of little wine shops in Paris when we had our baguette and cheese and charcuterie and a bottle of wine sitting in a park in Paris.
Wine always tastes better at the source, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't it? Yeah.
That's part of your secret to success here.
It tastes particularly well sitting on that deck over there, looking out over the vineyard and having the creek bubbling right past you and everything. Breathing in the fresh air and getting away from the world's troubles and everything. That's kind of what it's about out here.
Have you gotten any particular help from, let's just say, the Virginia Wine Marketing Board? Some organization like that? I mean, what's their outreach like? I'm curious about that.
Yeah, we're, you know, for a little plucky state, we're pretty organized. We've got a dedicated office with three or four full-time people that work to market the state overall as a region, et cetera. We've got a fantastic state viticulturist. Tony Wolf is world famous, and he's been working with all of us for well before I started. We had a state winemaker at Virginia Tech. Since retired, Bruce Auckland has been fantastic to support us all. The state, for a fairly conservative state, I think, has been very smart and focused and supportive in terms of recognizing that this is a up-and-coming, high-value kind of agricultural operation, and agritourism obviously plays a big deal in it. So we have all kinds of, we've got a vineyard association and a wineries association, and through COVID we relied on the legal support that we got from the wineries association.
Yeah, I think they were, I've been
what we were allowed to do and what we couldn't do and so forth, and it's really been incredibly supportive actually.
Oh, I think you have a customer.
Okay, so we'll be right back.
Well, we're just finishing up here talking about the type of support the state has given the industry, and what I was starting to say was, I've been a member of the Virginia Wineries Association myself since 2017, when I was in California still, because I wanted to understand what was going on.
Yeah.
And I've been uber impressed with the type of support you're talking about, the legal, the compliance, and everything they've been given during this whole COVID period.
Right.
I've been reading all the bulletins, reading everything. If I was a winery owner, which I'm not, I'd have been really like, this is spot on.
Yeah. I think the wine industry came together very well. You know, it's in general, I'd say we're all a bunch of independent cowboys. You know, we all do our own thing. We all think what we're doing is the only, my way or the highway is the only way to do it. But under this, we realized that we all needed to make sure we were unified and compliant and supportive. And we didn't really have anybody who said, well, screw that, I'm going to continue to do whatever I wanted, because we recognized that you get a target on your back otherwise if you're kind of too good for everything.
Right.
So I think everybody really very diligently made sure we followed all the procedures and everything. It doesn't do us, society or industry or anything, any good to be a source of spreading of a virus or anything. And so when we were allowed to open up again, we didn't open up right away. It took a couple of weeks, and we basically went through all our procedures step by step, and almost like football plays where you do them in slow motion and you practice mm-hmm. them and you do them again, you know, to make sure we had all the different provisions and everything in place, so that when people come out here, they tell me that they feel like this is one of the few places they go because they're comfortable out here and safe in this environment. And so we've been super strict about it the entire time. We limit the number of people, even though we have a beautiful, expansive lawns and everything. I just got to make sure that everybody can stay apart, and we have limited number of people in the tasting room at any one time, and that type of thing. We even have that hand washing station in the front as you come in the
right.
building, for example, too. So we're treating it pretty seriously, and as a result, we don't have any, knock on wood, we haven't had any real issues where people, you know, would come here and not want to comply. They recognize that this is a place that's doing it by the book, and they appreciate that, I guess. So that's just us, you know. But I think the industry was pretty good about this overall, and the state has recognized that we're kind of an outlet for people, I guess. Not a lot of places you can go, but you can go to beautiful lawns and winery sites and have a few pops and fresh air and feel like you're a little bit refreshed in the face of a very stressful time, obviously.
This has been as good as I thought it might be. I really enjoyed this conversation. It's really a pleasure to meet you. When we're off tape, I'll tell you who you remind me of, an old friend of mine. Again, I'll say thank you for your time, and good luck and continued success.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Well, folks, I hope you found my interview with Scott as enjoyable as I did. The backstory about his branding of Ducard I found to be very intriguing. He was as gracious as any winery owner I've ever met, and I would encourage you to seek out his wines. They're in small supply, but I know you will love them as much as I do. In my next episode, we take a trip into the world of champagne and sparkling wine. I had the pleasure to sit down with Claude Thibault, the owner and winemaster at Thibault Jamison, who is the foremost producer of sparkling wine here in Virginia today. Claude has a very distinguished background, and he was born in one of the Cru villages in Champagne. His experience producing champagne in France and sparkling wine, both in California and here in Virginia, is unmatched by anyone in the industry. I would suggest you buy a bottle and enjoy it while you listen to his interview. Thank you for being a listener. Please hit that subscribe button so you won't miss an episode or one of my posts on my website. Any comments you would like to share, send them to me at fred@finewineconfidential.com. See you on the other side. Music at Fine Wine Confidential podcast by Jason Shaw at audionautics.com from his copyrighted song Acoustic Shuffle under Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International License. I hope you enjoyed the show.